They say the world can be hard, cruel, and ugly. Trust me, it gets worse if your hunger and thirst doesn't push you from position last place to first. Can't build a foundation without having feet in the dirt. So I put in the work, grind harder than most. I don't chase accolades of the living, I'm facing a ghost. That's what makes me the GOAT. Depending on who you ask, my brother, whatever task, got it covered like a mask. Guaranteed they can't see me at the open run, cause I cook competitors until they look well done. Don't act like you don't know where I hail from. I had to climb up out the trenches, sit on benches till my time had come. Don't be mad at the player, be mad at the game. Sneak dissing and hating, that's a flag on the play. Me falling off, huh, that'll be the day. I'm like Bolt in the race, leave the track flambé. It's the open run.
You knew the job was hard and you took it. And you took it anyway. You clearly didn't understand the assignment. Don't come at me left, because you have to realize I'm a different type of animal, but I'm the same beast. It can happen. It's not a threat. It just is what it is. With that being said, I'd like to welcome you to The Open Run with Will Strickland. The Open Run with Will Strickland is brought to you by the fine folks at Press. We are press.net. I can be found across these rough interweb streets at W_Strickland and the number one on Twitter, Will Strickland and the number one on IG, and across all streaming platforms where podcasts can be found. Different animal, same beast. A game changer. I've been blessed and fortunate in my life to have the kind of lens to see the world in a way that I wanted to change certain things about it. I always wanted to avoid the cookie cutter so I can get this gingerbread, man. And there are a lot of people who've come on this planet to do the same things. A couple of great lights have been extinguished from this earth. One in particular, Sir Sidney Poitier. When I was a kid and I was acting in all the elementary school plays and stuff like that, and then middle school and then high school, I did that up until the 11th grade at least. I was always the lead. And there was a reason for that. I wanted people to see me. I wanted people to understand that I was just as human as they were. I didn't get that as a kid. Come on, I'm not being extra with that. But I wanted to be recognized for sure. I went out for the Wizard of Oz when I was in kindergarten. I wanted to be Oz because that name was in the title. I know that wasn't the main character. Kids. But Poitier marked the first time white American audiences could, quote unquote, accept, quote unquote, or tolerant. I say this all the time. People are they tolerate a little burn on their toes. They tolerate a rash. They don't tolerate people, but those are the words people use today. So they tolerated this black character as a lead, whether he's breaking out of jail with Tony Curtis and chained to him and had to figure out in an interracial situation how they could work together to make the thing right. Or guess who's coming to dinner when you saw this interracial relationship in the film. When you saw him as a black man smack this other white man on the screen, that was shocking for people in the 60s to see a black man stand up like him. But he was so genteel to some people. So he can get away with it. And people thought that because he wasn't threatening in an overt way, that he still didn't have intensity. He didn't have a fire inside of him. But watch some of those performances. They call me Mr. Tibbs. That's one of my favorites. We're calling you out, Seymour Pettigrew. He was instrumental in being one of those faces that people saw that said, hey, maybe we can accept the black face as a lead. Eventually, he did something that most artists, especially when studios in the early 70s, were trying to figure out how to bring a wider audience to their films. In the midst of recessions and all kinds of malaise from the Vietnam War, movie ticket sales were down. Audiences were different. They were changing. And would the movie industry change with it? And then a man by the name of Melvin Van Peebles, who we talked about on his podcast just recently, made a movie called Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song. Started this thing called Blaxploitation. And that industry spawned a bunch of films that people saw as destructive or stereotypical to the black community, part of an endemic toward the black community. He was a game changer. That movie was a game changer. Sidney Poitier winning an Oscar, the first black man to ever win an Oscar as lead in a film in 1964, was a game changer. The next time it happened after that was 2002 with Denzel Washington playing what? A dirty cop in Training Day. For all the other roles he played that were so great, from playing Stephen Biko in Cry Freedom to Malcolm X, whatever the case might be, he wins it for being a dirty cop. Okay. But I wanted to be Sidney Poitier. I wanted to be Walter Younger and Raisin in the Sun. Sidney Poitier started making, I guess, higher end blaxploitation films with Bill Cosby, you know, whether it be Uptown Saturday Night or Let's Do It Again, one of my favorites of all time, where we learn the names of some of our favorite rappers, or at least one of them, Mr. Hiawatha Smalls, AKA Call Me Biggie. He's connected to hip hop culture. He's connected to our communities. He's connected to actors. He's connected to being in the right place at the right time. This confluence of civil rights, which he was a great activist for, interracial relationships. People felt a certain way about him with everything, you know, with the good, there is the bad. And there are some things that were bad about Sidney Poitier. As perfectly imperfect humans, we all have our faults and flaws. I'm coming here to praise Caesar today, not to bury him. And within that filmography and everything he did, and I talked about blaxploitation, there's a man who passed away just recently by the name of Max Julian, who in the 80s in Detroit, Michigan, the Max Julian jacket was like a coveted jacket. People were dying for it, but Max Julian was the Mac. He's been in a bunch of other stuff, but that's what people know him best for, the movie The Mac, playing the pimp Goldie, and want to get out of life and do something positive in the community. It is rumored that the proceeds from that movie were given to the Black Panther Party to help sustain their free lunch program for young people in disadvantaged communities in Oakland in particular and throughout the country. But rest in peace to Max Julian. Rest in peace to Sidney Poitier. Rest in peace to Jesse D from the groundbreaking and game-changing Force MCs, later to be known as the Force MDs out of Staten Island, New York. Yes, there were rappers out of Staten Island before Wu-Tang, before UMCs. These guys were the progenitors. So many of their members have passed on. So rest in power to Jesse D. And rest in power to another man. I just mentioned Biggie Smalls, Notorious B.I.G., Blessed Dead. I also want to mention the man who wrote or was a co-writer on Biggie's first hit, James M. Toomey, died. The son of jazz great Jimmy Heath, who performed with everyone, I'm talking about James M. Toomey, from Miles Davis to Stephanie Mills and Phyllis Hyman, the late Phyllis Hyman, Blessed Dead. His contribution to hip-hop and samples with his music, with his musicianship, he was a real one. James M. Toomey, Juicy Fruit. Biggie Smalls, Juicy. Game changers. What else has changed the game is positionless basketball. Where did it start? I want to blame May 16th, 1980, when one Irvin Magic Johnson filled in for the league's MVP, the artist formerly known as Ferdinand Louis Alcindor, and played all five positions in the game as a rookie to be Hall of Famers Bobby Jones and my favorite player of all time, Julius Winfield Irving II, in the NBA Finals. He jumped center, played every single position, 42, 15, and 7, still the greatest finals performance of all time. There is no competition. There is no doubt. Don't at me. It is what it is. And we look at teams like the Miami Heat with He Who Shan't Be Named or Golden State, even the San Antonio Spurs to some degree, even though the great Timothy Theodore Duncan was still playing for them. The way the ball moved, it was ball movement, man movement that made the game look so fluid. And now, to be able to get on the court, no matter what position you play, you have to have skills. Recently, we've seen the Toronto Raptors, one of the hottest teams in the league right now, on a six-game losing strike. Not worried about the men's dim. Gordon Dragic posting workout videos at the Miami Heat's facility and then deleting it off the internet. They have an all-star in Fred VanVleet who's looking like he's going to be chosen, even if he's not chosen by the fans. More than likely, he'll be chosen by the coach who coaches that game. It looks like it'll be either Billy Donovan or Stephen John Nash, so it could happen. But he's running everything from an all-guard and wing lineup to starting people like Pascal Siakam at the point or Scottie Barnes to the point with OG Anunoby and Chris Boucher and Precious Achiuwa. Like, he's running big lineups too. To have that kind of flexibility and then know how to employ it means something. And within all of that is their all-star, Fred VanVleet, who became the first player in NBA history to record back-to-back games of 35-plus points and 10-plus assists with zero turnovers. The man just got his first triple-double with 37, 10, and 10 versus the Utah Jazz and recently dropped another 32-point gem against the New Orleans Pelicans. Some teams go positionless because they have no choice. Case in point, the Los Angeles Lakers, who can do nothing with the rotting remains of Highland DeAndre Jordan Jr. and can't keep the once great Dwight David Howard on the court because he can't space the floor, he can't guard on the perimeter anymore, He's 35 plus years old. It's not going to happen, not in an effective way. So who have they had going to the center? You know, the hashtag, who shan't be named. And before this past weekend's game versus the Memphis Grizzlies, also on a season-long 9-game losing streak themselves now, we're 5-0 with he who shan't be named playing at the center position. You know, the position that Anthony Davis bitched about playing? If it helps your team to win, you do what you need to do. And he's been magnificent at this point. He makes history almost every day he plays. Much like Barack Hussein Obama, for every day he was in the White House and every day that Kamala Harris is in the vice president's home, making history, changing the game. He's now fourth on the all-time list of free throws made, surpassing the great Oscar Robertson and dominating in the middle, even though the Lakers are getting killed on the boards, to keep them afloat until Anthony Davis comes back and is telling them that they have to stay basically positionless. I mean, Anthony Davis started off as a point guard in high school, used those skills to become one of the best players in the league. Some say not the top 75, but it is what it is. And with the King averaging 37, 13, and 7 over this stretch, he's in I Show You How to Do This Son mode. He's been criticized for how he went at former teammate Tristan Thompson, who was on the bench at the end of the game against the Kings. But Kings coach Alvin Gentry said, doesn't matter whether he's playing the 5, the 4, the 3, the 2, the 1, the 6, 7, or the 8. He's going to be great either way. He's going to help any team he plays for. Embrace it. Enjoy it. It is what it is. This past weekend's matchup between the Lakers and the Hawks marked the 50th anniversary of the longest losing streak in NBA history when the 71-72 Lakers, the NBA champion Lakers, posted a 33-game losing streak. 41% of your season, basically undefeated by the LA Lakers, who had just had a young man by the name of, and I couldn't call him young, I think he was 37 at the time, so Elgin Baylor retire, and Jerry West, Gail Goodrich, and the late Wilton Norman Chamberlain went on a 33-game losing streak. Amazing. And a very disappointing season to date for both teams, really, but for the Hawks, who made it all the way to the Eastern Conference Finals. Their GM, Travis Schlenk, expressed regret over keeping the same team and basically running it back in hopes of making it back there. But I guess the guys sniffed too much of their paper. Do people still read newspapers? Let me stop. I guess they can't smell the ink. Anyway, in a radio interview recently, Schlenk stated that he had regrets for keeping the team together as it was because guys got too comfortable. They even said they were bored this season. How can you be bored? You hadn't won anything. Making it to the Eastern Conference Finals is great, but what is your ultimate goal? The ultimate goal of the Golden State Warriors is to win a championship, to put back the old band once again, and we want to welcome back one Clay Alexander Thompson, who had 17 points in his return to the court after almost 3 years, 900 plus days away from the court, and he said the Warriors made every day away from the court worth it. In a home game versus the Cleveland Cavaliers, he scored 17 points on 7 of 18 shooting, so it's still a little rusty, but he had a poster dunk on the big lineup that J.B. Bickerstaff runs there with basically 4 7-footers in his starting lineup. Clay had the dunk, they went on to get the win. Happy for Clay. Those guys are the small ball. Used to run the death lineup against the Cleveland Cavaliers in the playoffs with Draymond in the middle. We'll talk about a little bit more later on in the program. Andre Iguodala, Clay, Steph, and whoever else they put on the court that would move the ball with them. Golden State can play small ball and have the ultimate small ball lineup because of their ability to shoot, slash, and score from almost any area on the court. When you have Wardell, Stephen Curry, the second on that team, you have range and it opens up the floor in a way you cannot imagine. Another team welcoming someone back is the Brooklyn Nets, with the returning Kyrie Andrew Irving off of his mini retirement. I guess felt it was like when the game was changed for him, and you know, the Nets changed the game to make sure he plays. But I'm wondering, if Golden State and the Nets make it to the NBA Finals, would Kyrie Irving even be able to play, even if they were the road team? So you get 4 road games in Golden State, but San Francisco will not allow Kyrie Irving unvaxxed to play either. But he came back against Indiana, scored 22 points, 10 in the fourth quarter to help them win a game where my man Lance Stephenson went off. Make him dance, Lance. We'll talk about him a little bit later in the podcast. But again, would it bode well for the Nets to be a 5-8 seed, or at least a 5 or 6 seed in the East, so that Kyrie can play more games on the road than he's unable to at home? Will his vacation away from the game he says he's appreciated inspire him to go get vaccinated, call himself Vaxil Foley, Pfizer Soze, Quentin Quarantino? Well, what I do know is that you can call us the Open Run with Will Strickland, and we'll be back for more on the other side of this. Stay tuned. Back giving you more of what you asked for. It's the Open Run with Will Strickland in conversation with a man raised in the forest. If you try to diss, what do you do to rappers when they try to diss? When you're raised in the forest, sir?
Best kept.
You diss the motherfucker.
All right.
No doubt. My man, Diamond D. What's up, man?
What's good, man? I'm glad to be here.
I appreciate you coming on, man. And like I was saying before we got on, and I talked about Forest Projects, if people don't know when I said Raising Forest, if you are a fan of this man's music, his discography is select. His history with his crew, select. Top shelf, premier. And we're going to go through that, as well as a bunch of other things with him. But I want to welcome you on. And what I normally do when I have guests come on the show is run their resume. Now, you have you're the new hombre in town. It's Diamond D. And I want you to run your resume, sir, and let people know a little bit about who you are, sir.
Well, you want me to go back like that?
I mean, just a little bit with you. I'm going to go with you. I mean, I started in Forest. You know, I could have talked about,
it's all good because, you know, we're going to converse, but I hate when I do interviews and they're like, yo, you know, for the people who don't know, tell us a little bit, you know, that like, that's your job.
No, and I'm with that, right?
Yeah.
And this is where, like, when we were talking before we got on, talking right. about, you know, your first tour and coming down to Houston and the whole nine, like, all that is love. But what I like to do is talk about, like, how, you know what? I got it. Let's do this thing called the association, or the award association game. I'm throwing some names out to you, and you tell me what you think when you hear these names and what they mean to you, okay?
All right.
John Baez.
The teacher.
The teacher. Not Lawrence Krishna Parker, the teacher, but one of your teachers.
My teachers. John Baez. So yes,
if they know who that is, if you want to reveal.
Jazzy J,
the first artist ever signed to Def Jam, if people didn't know that, right. that connection.
Well, you know what? I don't know if he was signed to Def Jam, but he produced I Need a Beat.
Right.
LL Cool J.
Right, even before that, if I'm not mistaken, when he did It's Yours, the joint with Tila Rock.
You know what? You're right. It's Yours. Right.
But, 84.
You know, I Need a Beat was Def Jam all the way.
But, no doubt.
But It's Yours had the Def Jam imprint. But what was the other label? It was Party Time.
Right. Right. Yeah, so, I mean, we talk about him as his foundation.
Right. Yeah, definitely right.
But him as foundation for you, what does he mean to you?
Man, he was the first one to like really take me under his wing and appreciate what I was trying to do and taught me the fundamentals of a production.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like with the first joint I did with him, I'm Not Playing. I was in the group Ultimate Force.
Right. right? Master Rob. Shout out to right? Master Rob.
So I went there with the 45. I'm like, yo, I want you to sample this part for the chorus. You know, but like I knew what I wanted, but I didn't know how to program.
Right.
You know what I mean? So I would watch him and then, you know, once I was signed to the label, just sitting in sessions with him and watching him work on the SB-12 and then later on the MPC-60.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was able to pick up a lot. So when you say John, you say Jay Baez, that's what that means to me. He's the teacher, the mentor.
Definitely. Okay. Robert Hall.
Robert Hall. What can you say? You know, we've been friends before we were like, you know, before we were 10 years old.
Right. That's dope.
You know, top lyricist, top producer, DJ, triple threat.
No doubt.
Now, for those who don't know, I am talking about the LORDFINESSE, Lord Finesse,
right?
No doubt. Some of your early work with him on the Return of the Funky Man stuff and all that stuff, that's really seminal to what, when we think of Bronx MCs and the early days of that with Ultra Mag, with KRS, with Lord Finesse, like that is some of the earliest stuff that really gives you that, the early feel of boom bap. What was, when you're doing your production, these early days of your production, what were you thinking about? What was inspiring you at the time?
Well, what was inspiring me personally was to use samples that nobody else touched.
Mm.
When you go back to Lord Finesse's first album, The Funky Technician.
Right. Did I say Return of the Funky Man?
That's the second album.
Right. I meant to say the one with him and Mike Smooth on the front.
That's the Funky Technician.
Right. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, it's so good. We right here.
No doubt.
But yeah, you know, that song Bad Mother, you know, I was the first to use that sample.
Mm-hmm.
I was the first one to use the sample that Dos FX later used and blew up off of.
Right.
You know what I mean?
And of course, you notice he's not telling them samples, so that's a no-no. That's a no-no.
Those records are like basic knowledge, but I'm not going to just shout it out there. But
No doubt. Yeah. But I think, you know, when you think about a guy like Lord Finesse, and the start of this thing, and we're going to get into that in a second, there's another guy I want to bring up when we play this association game, Riding LeMay.
That's Showbiz.
Yes, sir.
You know, we started off DJing together, and then that turned into us. We used to DJ together, and then that turned into us forming a production company, Digging in the Crates.
We're definitely going to talk about that in a second, including, and I think, you know, I should have said this with when I was talking about Lord Finesse, is the, rest in peace, Big L, Lamont Coleman.
Mm, Big L, died too soon. Lord Finesse brought Big L in. He brought L in, I brought in Fat Joe.
Mm-hmm.
Buck Wild brought in OC. But yeah, Big L gone too soon. I wish he would have, you know, at least got a chance to see his album go gold.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. But let's talk about, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Good.
You know, you started talking about how you guys were formed like Voltron. You had this crew. What was the impetus behind creating this thing called DITC, and why did you call it Digging in the Crates? Like, what did you want people to know Digging in the Crates?
Because the whole thing was to just dig for shit. Don't just use, at the time, breakbeats. Mm. No disrespect to the breakbeats.
Mm.
Like, you know, we were from the Bronx. So all of them records on the breakbeat albums, we didn't heard them shits in the parks.
Right.
But we didn't realize that to the rest of the country. It was like, oh, shit, this is where they're getting them records from? You know what I mean? But, like, to us, it was like, yeah, okay, you know. But anyway, that was the premise behind the name Digging in the Crates. All of us, me, Finesse, Showbiz and AG, Big L, OC, and Fat Joe. The main premise was to just use samples that nobody else used.
And when y'all got together, like, I'm trying to figure out, like, what is that? What was that first meeting? Like, yo, we should form this crew based on our love for this music.
It ain't really go like that because we were already fucking with each other.
Right. So it was more organic than anything.
And then one day we were just like, okay, yeah, we're going to call ourselves, you know, the Digging in the Crates crew.
Right.
No, like it wasn't no drawn out induction or nothing. we were already like, you listen, when I did Lord Finesse's first album, right? Mm. Everybody knew each other.
Right.
But there's no Digging in the Crates.
Right.
But we all knew each other, you know, cause we all live like, you know, in a two or three block radius.
That's dope. That's, you know, crazy,
I mean,
as hell.
So I don't know, just weird.
No, I mean, you know, you said it wasn't a formal thing. It was just something that worked itself out.
It was real organic.
Right?
It was real organic.
The way I was introduced to Showbiz and AG was through stuff that you had done with them. And also through my man, Carlos Garza, down in Houston, who was working with a young man who was in a group called the Inner Circle Posse. I used to go by the name of DJ, what's known better as DJ Premier. And he bought some joints that Show was selling out of the trunk of his car, and with Soul Clap.
Right.
Still got them old red label joints, the Showbiz Records joints.
Yep.
And being a part of that and being part of that sound, that feel that came out of that time, like, what was it like working with Sho and AG? I spoke to AG the other day. He said, what's up? And Happy New Year and everything. What was that like working with those cats? Because they were really a great introduction for me into the Digging in the Crates crew.
Again, you know, we all knew each other. You know what I mean? So the shit was just organic. And like I said, you know, me and Sho, you know, we were already fucking with each other as far as the music, just on some DJing shit. Mm-hmm. At the time, you know, at the time, I really wasn't rhyming yet. I didn't start rhyming until like maybe like 91. Mm-hmm. But me and Sho go back to the mid 80s.
So when you talk about starting to rhyme in 91, what was the thing that told you, yeah, this is something I can do? Because there are a lot of people that say, you know, this person was the first producer who turned to, you know, being a rapper, whatever the case might be. You consider yourself the greatest producer who raps, who's on the mic. Right. And because of maybe recency bias, where people see the Kanye's, they see the Pharrell's, they see the Tyler, the Creators. They even remember Dre, even though he wasn't a guy who was writing. He didn't right. have a pen like that. But because he was a producer and he was rapping, once he started rapping for NWA, they considered him, but they weren't looking at Diamond D in that way. Why do you think that is?
I think they were looking at me in that way. And all of the three people you just named, they all, you know, they all said they all told me that I was their influence.
Oh, I know that the producers know you like that. I'm talking about like from a mainstream consumer standpoint, uh-huh. where people go, oh yeah, Kanye this or blah blah that. Are they saying, well, you don't remember Diamond D was one of the first ones that came out? When you listen to even on, you know, Tribe Called Quest Show Business and stuff like that, you hear him talk about, you don't want to make a pitch that's wild. Talking about his career and what it is to be in this business and one of those guys who are producing a lot of early hits in the day. Right. They didn't look at it the same way that they look at those guys.
Well, my album never went platinum. So let's start there.
Okay, you know, Stunts, Blunts, and Hip Hop.
Right. So, you know, when you go platinum, you got more eyes on you.
Okay, you fair
know,
enough.
You know, we're just talking numbers now.
Right, which is different than actually creating classics that people can still mention to this day.
The question was, why do I think my name doesn't come up with the Ye's or the Pharrells?
Mm.
Even though both of them acknowledge me as being one of their influences, one of them.
100%. 100%.
You know what I mean? So, I mean, you know, what the fuck can I do?
No, you can't, but here's the thing. We have this great vehicle. We have this great vehicle right. now called social media.
Yeah. No
right,
doubt.
We're able to do stuff like this and talk about that, so people do know, and they can go and they can dig in the crates themselves, right. and they can see on your first album, Stunts, Blust, and Hip Hop, which is clearly a play on sex, drugs, and rock and roll, right? But for our community, right, from where we come from,
right,
and some classics off that joint, like I put instrumentals in between the quarters on my podcast,
no doubt,
and so all of this is dedicated to you today. I was like, okay. I can't use everything from this album. I got to take some stuff from Dime Piece 1, Dime Piece 2. I have to use stuff from Gotham. Like, I want to be able to not only talk about what was, but what is as well, because you're still out here and active.
Yeah.
So,
no doubt. And also, let me say, well, you know, for the most part, most people who work at hip hop magazines and a lot of these bloggers are not as well versed as you are with a lot of the earlier boom bap shit. You know, just the little shit that we've been talking about thus far, and the interview just started.
Right.
You know, I can tell you know your shit.
I got you, man. So, this is in my blood. This is what right. we do. This is how we grew up. Like before, I tried to explain to people, like before it had a name, before it was in a shrink wrap in a jewel box on a shelf somewhere, you know, right. before we can go on tour, like we were in the bathroom with the hairbrush. That was our Madison Square Garden. You know what I mean? That was our Staples Center, whatever it's called today, right? That's where okay. we did our thing. And you talk about the park jams or whatever, but your name rings out, period. I mean, a lot of people don't even really know that you are a Grammy winner. You talked about not going platinum, but you won a right. Grammy. Because mm-hmm. versatility, you're talking about being a triple threat like Laura Finesse.
Right.
You know, producer, rapper, DJ. As producer, you produce some stuff that people don't know or might not have known that you were a part of. You know, your remix game is heavy, that's for sure. But can you tell people what you did to win a Grammy, even though you didn't go platinum as it's That's never right. a solo artist.
Right.
Because you will never say you had a solo album. You have an album that, whether it's about your crew, your name is on it for sure. But you always wanted to elevate other artists, which I thought was always dope to me.
Right. Well, the Fugees. I won a Grammy for the Fugees. The title track, The Score.
I mean, you can't be disconnected from that. The name of the album right. is The Score. And you produced the title track. So title that's, track. I mean,
right.
that's something,
even
right?
Though, yeah, even though what propelled that album were the Killing Me Softlys and the Ready or Nots, you know, and all of those songs. But just to be a part of that, you know, was definitely a good look.
That's dope because they were this close to being dropped. I was at
right
in the That's Sony true. Building when they were about to get dropped. If Salam Remy, another dope producer,
didn't save
them. The Nappy Heads, he saved them basically.
Yeah, yeah.
He saved that. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you're
Shout
this close.
To Salam.
No doubt, yeah. right? But having being a part of that and having someone like a Wyclef call you up and say, yo, I respect what you do.
Right.
How can you be down with this? I mean, that is, you know, not only the height of respect, not only as a producer, but also as someone who writes.
Right.
Someone who DJs, who remixes, who masters everything, who's really into the production process. And I want to get into more of that on the other side of this, on The Open Run with Will Strickland. Now listening to the sounds of The Open Run with Will Strickland, where the lecture is conducted from the mic into the speaker. In conversation, my man, Diamond D.
Yo, what up?
Diamond D. Look, man, what were your goals when you first got into this sport? Like, what is it you really want to do?
Just make some timeless music. You know what I mean? When I first got into the game, you know, I just wanted my scratches to be heard on a record.
I mean, that's yeah, basic, but at the end of the day, like, you want to leave a legacy, no?
Of course. But you said when I first,
mm-hmm.
you know what I mean?
We were young cats.
Like my introduction, like, I was a DJ. That was my introduction.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're a DJ, you know, it's major in your head for you to hear your scratches on the radio.
Right.
You know, I went through that. You know what I mean? But you know, when my priorities shifted, you know, then you know you hit certain plateaus. You remember those as well too. You know what I mean?
Tell me some of those plateaus though. I'm interested to know, like, from where it started to those next plateaus. What were the things as you got older, as you matured, that you learned more about the business and about what you really wanted from this thing? What are those steps you took?
Oh man, shit! You know, finding the right lawyer. I can't hear you.
You can't hear me right now?
Now I can. It's like a delay or some shit. I don't know. You muted your mic? Like your mic is muted.
These rough interweb streets won today as we had some technical difficulties on this end. So we dropped off with Diamond. But I want to let you know that you can reach out to Diamond D via social media at Diamond DITC. That's Digging in the Crates, both on Twitter and on Instagram. And of course, you can continue listening to more of The Open Run with Will Strickland on the other side of this. Time on The Open Run with Will Strickland. I want to thank my man Diamond D for coming through and spreading love. It is the Bronx way, if you didn't know already. And now on to the news, views, and truths that you choose on the NBA and beyond. Gino claps back. Gino Auriemma, Well, I guess his ears were burning because of what Muffet McGraw said, and I spoke about this last week on the podcast, how she felt as though ESPN has a Connecticut bias, how the coverage of the Lady Huskies is excessive, that other teams don't get highlighted as much, and Gino clapped back at her. Muffet gets bored. Then he put his dick on the table and said, oh, look at all these championships I won. She's won too. And like, whoa, my guy. Not only were you tone deaf in saying what you said about this woman, trying to silence and mute a voice necessary as we try to elevate women's basketball and make sure we're supporting that. You're a coach of a women's basketball team. Why would you do that? It's disrespectful. She gets bored. Really? She should do something else. Enjoy her retirement. Damn. You think he was Lorenzo Tejada on Power, if you watched that show. Putting Mary J. Blige, quote unquote, in her place. Nah, not going to fly. And it seems like that's a disease going around right now. It's people trying to maintain positions. You don't have to protect your legacy. My God, you don't have to lie to kick it. It's okay. She can say what she wants to say. You don't have to get all upset about it. That's how she feels. Your championships are in stone. She does have a point about Connecticut, but again, she also has to realize, and so does Gino, that winning brings certain privileges. It happens. Not a lot of winning is going on down at the University of Memphis. Then the men's basketball team is not hurting projected first-round pick Jalen Duren, the big man in the middle for them, but it's hurting the youngest player in college basketball today, Imani Bates, who made the choice to go down to Memphis as opposed to going to the G League Ignite, getting paid to play. I'm not going to say if he's getting paid to play in Memphis, because I can guarantee it's not as much as he would have made playing for the G League Ignite. But people expect him to be this all-star player right at the gate at 17 years old, who already had questionable shot selection and a me-first attitude when he's playing AAU basketball. This is some of the things that people knock about AAU basketball. It's showing itself in poor shooting percentages in college, injuries. Again, not understanding the college game yet, but he's 17 years old. Some people are made out to be something they're not because of mixtapes and highlights, showdowns against projected number one pick Chet Holmgren when they were both in high school. But Imani Bates, is his draft stock dropping? Absolutely, the way he's playing right now. So there's a choice. Does he come back to Memphis next year, or does he go and play for the G League Ignite team? The choice is yours, young man. I just love the fact that he has a choice. He has time to develop and become a better player, take these bumps and bruises, and turn his initial stumbling blocks into stepping stones. The number two Duke Blue Devils are upset in the ACC as conference play starts by the University of Miami Hurricanes with a Cam McGusty. I just want to say Cam McGusty on the podcast. He made a big layup down the stretch to edge Duke by two. Another team projected to do lots of things. Bill Self's Kansas Jayhawks were upset by the Texas Tech Red Raiders of the old Southwest Conference, now in the Big 12. I love the energy of college basketball, and I also love the energy of my man, make him dance, Lance. Shout out to Lance Stevenson. As I said earlier in the podcast, in his game against the Nets with Kyrie coming back, he had 20 points in the first quarter. He's never done that in his career. Ended up with 30. They lost the game. I'm happy for Lance, a guy who was last seen playing in China and also in the G League. I saw him last in the Goat Park, Rocksteady Park, for those who are in the know, at 99th in Amsterdam and New York City, watching Full Court 21, enjoying that. He's back in the NBA and doing Lance things, but I think that the time away has also humbled Lance. He's still playing the air guitar. That'll always be Lance. But his energy and what he does is infuse something into the Indiana Pacers, who are in the midst of either blowing that whole thing up, really trying to make a push later on in the season once guys get over COVID, they get a core lineup back with Lance Stephenson being a big part of it. He just had his first double-double in a couple of years with 16 points and 14 assists, a career-high 14 assists, in a game that ultra-talented big man, Domantas Sabonis, scored 42 in. So good luck to the Indiana Pacers. And speaking of Sabonis, let's speak about Sabas 1.0 and wish a happy birthday, happy belated birthday to not my Vitas or your Vitas, but our Vitas Sabonis, one of the greatest big men in basketball history. If you know anything about basketball, if you take the time to look up our Vitas Sabonis in the 80s, I'm talking about Olajuwon Robinson, Shaq levels. His dominance in Europe with his game that was followed by a guy, the reigning and defending MVP of the league, Nikola Jokic, who I still haven't given a middle name to yet, but I will. Trust me, I will. This guy's averaging 26, 15, and 7. No one in the history of the game has had these kinds of stats. No one, except as he's been referred to by the whiplashed Markieff Morris, the 300-pound sloppy fat boy. Nikola Jokic has a player efficiency rating of 32. It's never happened. Not Michael Jeffrey Jordan, not the hashtag Cougar Champion name, not Wilton Norman Chamberlain, but the second-round pick, Nikola Jokic. As we approach the trade deadline for the NBA, some teams are moving some pieces around and letting go of some guys that may find a landing spot on a team with aspirations toward the championship. One in particular, the Denver Nuggets, making room for Bol Bol to have an opportunity to play. He is an internet sensation when he gets to the games. And a fan favorite in Denver will now have an opportunity to play in Detroit, who is not the worst team in the league now, at least record-wise. So hopefully he'll be able to get some time with Kay Cunningham and Dwayne Casey there in Motown. Also released and waived from his contract with Boston Celtics, Jabari Parker, who had a very bright future in the NBA, just couldn't stick. Now a journeyman, may find a place on a roster as well. Best of luck to you, Jabari. And last but not least, DeMarcus, Amir Cousins, he late of the Milwaukee Bucks, may find a quick flight 20 minutes south to Chicago, a fitting spot for him as they do need help on the glass, a backup big for Nikola Vucevic, Vucci Main. I don't see him going back to Los Angeles and playing with the other senior citizens there, but I think he'll be a help in Chicago. Let's see how it falls out for DeMarcus Cousins. Injury bugs hitting people all around. Jimmy Butler just got back off the injured list from a busted tailbone, now injured again with a sprained ankle, as is Dylan Brooks, who's out 3 to 5 weeks. Didn't stop Memphis from beating down the Lakers just recently. Dylan Brooks was a big part of their identity. He is definitely the carrier of the grit and grind, and the dog in him is also exhibited. And our player of the week this past week from the Western Conference, and Demetrius Jamal Morant, we must trust. He's on a tear right now. You can barely go on this guy. He can do everything. He can elevate, efficient at the rim, hangs in the air, makes these difficult finishes with either hand. The Western Conference Player of the Week, and in the Eastern Conference, as we talked about him a lot on last week's podcast, DeMar Darnell DeRozan from the Chicago Bulls, the East leading Chicago Bulls. Never in my sports broadcasting career would I ever think that I'd say the name Draymond Jamal Green Sr. so much in less than a 2-week span, but I'm saying it again from the Quinn Snyder Day-Day Appreciation Files here at the Open Run HQ. Draymond for MVP? I always said he was the most important player through all those championships for the Warriors, all three of them. Most valuable? Well, it depends on, and this is the argument between the best and most valuable. He is the most valuable player on that team. To the league, not so much. But I understand when you talk about the versatility of a guy who could be the defensive player of the year and is without question the heartbeat and quarterback of the culture of the Golden State Warriors is Draymond Green, who, as we look at our Power 10, a 30-9 record to lead the league and stay on top, especially during Clay Day. So nobody forgot about Dre Days. Now everybody remembers Clay Day. As Clay Alexander Thompson is being worked back into the fold with James Wiseman on the way, the Golden State Warriors are looking very dangerous and looking as a prohibitive favorite to win another NBA championship this year. At number two, the Phoenix Suns. At number three, the Chicago Bulls, who just had their 9-game losing streak snapped by the Luka Lamar Doncic, led Dallas Mavericks. And number four, the streaking hottest team in the National Basketball Association, the Memphis Grizzlies, on a 9-game losing streak themselves after a victory against the Lakers in LA that featured some of the greatest highlights you'll ever see from Demetrius Jamal Morant. They're at number four. At number five, the Utah Jazz. At number six, the Miami Heat. At number seven, the Milwaukee Bucks. At number eight, a precipitous drop for the Brooklyn Nets. At number nine, the Philadelphia 76ers, one of the hottest teams in the league as well, with a 6-game losing streak themselves. And at number 10, a new entry into the top 10, the Dallas Mavericks, led by 3-6 Lavia and Luka Doncic. Now, before we get out of here, I want to talk about the Houston Rockets, who have one of the worst records in the league and definitely not making the Power 10 at any point this season. But poor attitudes have stricken this squad. So Stephen Silas, the
maligned head coach of the Houston Rockets, suspended Kevin Porter Jr. and Christian Wood for a game. They came back and they played against the Washington Wizards recently. And Washington Wizards play-by-play announcer Kevin Corson, who announced when Kevin Porter Jr. hit a game-winning three-pointer to beat the Wizards, who have slid precipitously as well. After starting off 10-3, they're deep down in the Eastern Conference standings. But Corson said, "You've got to credit Kevin Porter Jr. Like his dad, he pulled that trigger at the right time." What people may or may not know is that Kevin Porter Jr.'s father, Brian Kevin Porter, went to jail for 4.5 years for manslaughter, shooting and killing of a 14-year-old girl. And after he served his time, was shot and killed in a bar. It's not even insensitive. This is ignorant. Then he issued a fugazi apology, saying that he thought that Kevin Porter Jr. was the son of the former holder, the single game assist record of 29 at one time before the gritty gutty Scotty Skiles broke it. With 30 in Orlando, Kevin Porter, who played for the then Washington Bullets, had 29 assists. He thought he's the same person, but now you can't say that because Kevin Porter, who played for the Washington Bullets, he doesn't have a gun charge and didn't kill anybody. He knew exactly what he was saying. That this guy still has a job is amazing to me. I don't know how, because you can't mistake those things as exacting as he was in his so-called effusive praise of the clutch shot making of Kevin Porter Jr. We're not buying it, but you understood the assignment when you started, because you knew the job was hard when you took it and you failed. But we will never fail you. So until next week, do remember, do what's popular with the population. Make sure you don't get beat off the dribble. And keep listening to The Open Run with Will Strickland. Rich kid, my mellow, my man, do what you do when you do what you do. Easy.